cracking at the bottom of a ravine, or the snuffing of a... Wait. What was that? Just a bird. Everything is amplified. Even my skin is alert, so that when the shadow launched by the sudden ascent of a turkey vulture passes overhead, I swear I can feel the temperature momentarily fall. I am the alert man. Hunting powerfully inflects a place. The ordinary prose of the ground, the literally down-to-earth, becomes as layered and springy as verse. Angelo, my Virgil in this world, has taught me how to read the ground for signs of pig. Notice the freshly rototilled soil at the base of that oak tree? Look how the earth has not yet been crisped by the midday sun. This means pigs have been rooting here since yesterday afternoon, either overnight or earlier this morning. See that smoothly scooped-out puddle of water? That's a wallow. But notice how the water is perfectly clear. Pigs haven't disturbed it yet today. We could wait here for them. Angelo says that the pigs, who travel in groups of a half dozen or so, follow a more or less fixed daily routine, moving from place to place, feeding, sleeping, cooling off. This grove of oaks is where they root for acorns, tubers, and grubs. In the afternoon heat, they snooze in oval nests scooped out of the dusty dirt beneath that protective tangle of manzanita. They cool off in these muddy wallows, the shores of which are letter-pressed with dainty hoofprints. They scrape the mud from their backs on that pine tree there, the one where the lower bark is rubbed smooth and tan. And they move from one such pig place to another along narrow lanes that temporarily part the thick pelts of rattlesnake grass clothing the hillsides. Since the grass springs back to erase their lanes after a few hours of sunshine, you can form a pretty good idea of how recently they've passed through here. On their appointed rounds, the pigs can cover 40 square miles a day. After hunting here for years, Angelo has come to the conclusion that there are three distinct groups sharing the oak forest and the grassy ridge above it like three overlapping nations, each with a slightly different map of good pig places. The hunter maintains his own mental map of the same ground, marked with auspicious spots, the places he has encountered pigs before, and the connecting routes he can navigate, which, of course, are far fewer than those available to the pigs. Unlike that of the pigs, the hunter's map also contains legal things like property lines and rights of way. The hunter's aim is to have his map collide with the pig's map, which, should it happen, will do so at a moment of no one's choosing. For although there's much the hunter can know about pigs and about their places, in the end he knows nothing about what is going to happen here today, whether the longed-for and dreaded encounter will actually take place, and, if it does, how it will end. Since there's nothing he can do to make the encounter happen, the hunter's energy goes into readying himself for it, and attempting, by the sheer force of his attention, to summon the animal into his presence. The drama of the hunt links the actors in it, predator and prey, long before they actually meet. Approaching his prey, the hunter instinctively becomes more like the animal, straining to make himself less visible, less audible, more exquisitely alert. Predator and prey alike move according to their own maps of this ground, their own forms of attention, and their own systems of instinct, systems that evolved expressly to hasten or avert precisely this encounter. Wait a minute. Did I really write that last paragraph? Without irony? That's embarrassing. I'm actually writing about the hunter's instinct, suggesting that the hunt represents some sort of primordial union between two kinds of animals, one of which is me? This seems a bit much. I recognize this kind of prose. Hunter porn. And whenever I've read it in the past, in Ortega y Gasset and Hemingway and all those hard-bitten, big-bearded American wilderness riders who still pine for the Pleistocene, it never failed to roll my eyes. I never could stomach the straight-faced reveling in primitivism, the barely concealed bloodlust, the whole macho conceit that the most authentic encounter with nature is the one that comes through the sight of a gun and ends with a large mammal dead on the ground. A killing that we are given to believe constitutes a gesture of respect. So it is for Ortega y Gasset, the Spanish philosopher, who writes in his Meditations on Hunting that the greatest and most moral homage we can pay to certain animals on certain occasions is to kill them. Please. And yet here I find myself sliding into the hunter's ecstatic purple, channeling Ortega y Gasset. It may be that we have no better language in which to describe the experience of hunting, so that all of us who would try sooner or later slide into this overheated prose ignorant of irony. Or it could be that hunting is one of those experiences that appear utterly different from the inside than from the outside. That this might indeed be the case was forcibly impressed upon me after my second trip hunting with Angela when, after a long and gratifying day in the woods, we stopped in at a convenience store for a bottle of water. The two of us were exhausted and filthy, the fronts of our jeans stained dark with blood. We couldn't have smelled terribly fragrant. And under the bright fluorescence of the 7-Eleven, in the mirror behind the cigarette rack behind the cashier, I caught a glimpse of this grungy pair of self-satisfied animal killers and noted the wide berth the other customers in line were only too happy to grant them. Us. It is a wonder that the cashier didn't preemptively throw up his hands and offer us the contents of the cash register. Irony. The outside perspective easily withers everything about hunting, shrinks it to the proportions of boys' play or atavism. And yet at the same time I found that there is something about the experience of hunting that puts irony itself to rout. In general, experiences that banish irony are much better for living than for writing. But there it is. I enjoyed shooting a pig a whole lot more than I ever thought I should have. A cannabinoid moment. Part of me did not want to go. The night before, I had anxiety dreams about hunting. In one, I was on a bobbing boat trying to aim a rifle at a destroyer that was firing its cannons at me. In the other, the woods were crawling with Angelo's Sicilian relatives, and I couldn't for the life of me remember how my gun worked, whether the safety was on when the little button popped up on the left side of the trigger or the right. I had tried out my rifle only once before taking it to the woods, at a firing range in the Oakland Hills. And by the end of the morning, my paper target had sustained considerably less damage than my left shoulder, which ached for a week. I wasn't ready to buy a gun of my own, so Angelo had borrowed a fairly basic pump-action rifle, a 270 Winchester with an old-fashioned sight that I had trouble getting used to. After my session at the range, the first order worry that I wouldn't have whatever it takes to fire a rifle aimed at an animal was overtaken by a second order worry that, assuming I did manage to pull the trigger, nothing of consequence would happen to the animal. The plan was to hunt boar in the sparsely populated northern reaches of Sonoma County, on a 1,000-acre property owned by a friend of Angelo's named Richard. Angelo hunts deer and turkey and duck, too, but for a number of reasons I felt more comfortable going for wild pig. The animal is regarded as a pest in many parts of California, and it seemed to me much easier to justify killing a pest than a wild native species that, like many waterfowl these days, is threatened by loss of habitat or overhunting. The pigs have been here a long time, but they are not native or even exactly wild. Feral would be more accurate. They are also, by reputation, vicious. One of the nicknames the California pig has earned is Dog Ripper. Columbus brought pigs to the New World on his second voyage in 1493. By the end of the following century, the Spanish had introduced domestic swine into the American South and California. It was their practice to release the animals into the woods, let them fatten on acorns and grasses, and then hunt them as needed. In the 1840s, Russian settlers brought domestic pigs with them to Northern California and, some years later, landowners introduced an unknown number of wild Eurasian boar, probably as a big game species. The wild boar and the feral pigs have long since interbred in California, and their hardy, intelligent offspring have flourished in California's oak forests and chaparral. People commonly refer to the animals as boar, but from the looks of them, the genes of domestic swine predominate. That said, California's wild pigs do have longer snouts, straighter tails, and much thicker bristles than their domestic forebears. In the absence of serious predators, the population of wild pigs has overrun many habitats, threatening farmland and vineyards and forest. They rip up great swaths of land with their rooting, exposing it to erosion and invasive weeds. So there was a story I could tell myself about the environmental rationale for hunting wild pig in California. But I also wanted to eat wild pig, more than I wanted to eat venison or duck or all the more diminutive birds Angelo likes to hunt. I like pork, and since coming to California, I'd heard how much tastier wild pigs are than either domestic hogs or the more full-blooded boar hunted in the South. I'd tasted that once, in a stew, and found it a little too musky. When I asked Angelo why he hunted wild pig, he didn't hesitate, or utter a word about the environment. Rather, he just kissed the tips of his fingers and said, "Because it is the most delicious meat. And there is nothing that tastes so good as boar prosciutto. You'll see. You shoot a big one and we'll make some." In a sense, that's what Angelo was really hunting. Not pigs so much as prosciutti. On one of our drives up to Sonoma, he'd talked a little about his philosophy of hunting and fishing. "For me, it is all about the eating, not the sport. I am not what you call a trophy hunter. I take what I need, enough to make a nice dinner for me and my friends, maybe some salami, a prosciutto, but then, that's it, I go home. My friend Xavier and I have this argument every time we go hunting or fishing. He keeps on fishing even after he's caught the limit, throwing the fish back, then catching it again. You know, catch and release. I tell him he's catching the same fish over and over. To me, that's playing with your food. You shouldn't play with your food." On this, my first outing, we were joined by Richard, the property's owner, whom Angelo had introduced to pig hunting, and Angelo's friend Jean-Pierre, a Frenchman who works as a chef at Chez Panisse in Berkeley. Jean-Pierre hadn't hunted in years, though he had grown up hunting boar with his relatives in Brittany. He had on one of those green felt alpine fedoras with the feather, a hat he managed to wear without so much as a trace of irony, and a pair of tall black riding boots. We didn't look much the part of an American hunting party. Angelo had on a pair of flouncy Euro-style black pants, though Richard did have on the full international orange regalia, and I was wearing my brightest orange sweater. We divided into pairs, me with Angelo, and went our separate ways, with a plan to meet back at the cars for lunch around noon. Jean-Pierre and Richard set off on the logging road that descended into the lower forest, while Angelo and I planned to reconnoiter the grassy ridge in Angelo's four-wheel drive ATV, what he calls his bike. The bike made a racket, but Angelo claimed it didn't bother the pigs and would allow us to cover a lot more ground than we could on foot. So we put our loaded rifles on mounts on the vehicle's hood. I arranged as much of my butt as I could fit onto the narrow plywood platform behind the driver's seat, and we set off in quest of pig, bouncing noisily down the dirt road. "You are going to kill your first pig today," Angelo shouted over the roar of the engine. Given the nature of hunting, not to mention me, I understood this as less a prediction than a prayer. Around every curve of road we came upon another really good spot, or very prevalent area, and each such place had a hunting story attached to it. Indeed, the whole landscape soon became an epic of pig death, and pig death narrowly averted. There was the one about the sow Angelo couldn't bring himself to shoot because her piglets were trailing behind. But since then I learned that another pig would have adopted the babies. That's what they do, so maybe next time. There was the spot where he'd fired into a knot of pigs and hit two with one bullet. And then there was the place where he'd taken a long shot at a boar that must have been easily 300-400 pounds, but missed. A story about the big one that got away is all important, of course, since it imbues the hunting ground with mythical possibility. The big one was still out there somewhere. After a while, we parked the bike and set out on foot on our own. Angelo gave me a route and a destination. a wallow in a grassy opening at the bottom of a ravine, and told me to find a tree with a good view of it and wait there, perfectly still, for 20 minutes until I heard him whistle. He would make his way toward the same spot from another direction, in the hopes of driving some pigs into my field of vision. When I could hear Angelo's footsteps no more, my ears and eyes started tuning in. Everything. It was as if I dialed up the gain on all my senses, or quieted myself to such an extent that the world itself grew louder and brighter. I quickly learned to filter out the static of birdsong, of which there was plenty at that early hour, and to listen for the frequency of specific sounds, the crack of branches or the snuffling of animals. I found I could see farther into the woods than I ever had before, picking out the tiniest changes in my visual field at an almost inconceivable distance, just so long as those changes involved movement or blackness. The sharpness of focus and depth of field was uncanny, though, being nearsighted, I knew it well from the experience of putting on glasses with a strong new prescription for the first time. "Hunter's eye," Angelo said later when I described the phenomenon. He knew all about it. I found a shaded spot overlooking the wallow and crouched down in the leaves, steadying my back against the smooth trunk of a madrone. I rested my gun across my thighs and got quiet. The whoosh of air through my nostrils suddenly sounded calamitous, so I began inhaling and exhaling through my mouth, silencing my breath. So much sensory information was coming into my head that it seemed to push out the normal buzz of consciousness. The state felt very much like meditation, though it took no mental effort or exercise to achieve that kind of head-emptying presence. The simple act of looking and listening, tuning my senses to the forest frequencies of pig, occupied every quadrant of mental space and anchored me to the present. I must have lost track of time because the 20 minutes flashed by. Ordinarily, my body would have rebelled at being asked to hold a crouch that long, but I felt no need to change position or even to shift my weight. Later, it occurred to me that this mental state, which I quite liked, in many ways resembled the one induced by smoking marijuana. The way one's senses feel especially acute, and the mind seems to forget everything outside the scope of its present focus, including physical discomfort and the passing of time. One of the more interesting areas of research in the neurosciences today is the study of the brain's cannabinoid network, a set of receptors in the nervous system that are activated by a group of unusual compounds called cannabinoids. One of these compounds is THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. Another is anandamide, a recently discovered neurotransmitter manufactured in the brain, and named by its discoverer for the Sanskrit word for inner bliss. Whether made by the plant or the brain, cannabinoids have the effect of intensifying sensory experience, disabling short-term memory, and stimulating appetite. Scientists still aren't certain what the evolutionary utility of such a system might be. Some researchers hypothesize that the cannabinoids, like the opiates, play a role in the brain's pain relief and reward system. Others that they help regulate appetite or emotion. The experience of hunting suggests another theory. Could it be that the cannabinoid network is precisely the sort of adaptation that natural selection would favor in the evolution of a creature who survives by hunting? A brain chemical that sharpens the senses, narrows your mental focus, allows you to forget everything extraneous to the task at hand, including physical discomfort and the passage of time, and makes you hungry, would seem to be the perfect pharmacological tool for man the hunter. All at once, it provides the motive, the reward, and the optimal mindset for hunting. I would not be the least bit surprised to discover that what I was feeling in the woods that morning, crouching against a tree avidly surveying that forest grove, was a tide of anandamide washing over my brain. But whether I was actually having a cannabinoid moment or not, in the moments before Angelo's whistle pierced my vigil, I did feel as though I had somehow entered nature through a new door. For once, I was not a spectator, but a full participant in the life of the forest. Later, when I reread Ortega y Gasset's description of the experience, I decided that maybe he wasn't so crazy after all, not even when he asserted that hunting offers us our last best chance to escape history and return to the state of nature, if only for a time, for what he called a vacation from the human condition. When one is hunting, the air has another, more exquisite feel as it glides over the skin or enters the lungs. The rocks acquire a more expressive physiognomy, and the vegetation becomes loaded with meaning. But all this is due to the fact that the hunter, while he advances or waits crouching, feels tied through the earth to the animal he pursues, whether the animal is in view, hidden, or absent. The tourist in nature achieves no such immersion or connection. All he sees is a landscape, which is something made by history, and rather recently at that. His gaze conditioned by art and expectation, the tourist remains a spectator to a scene, unable to get outside himself or history, since the landscape he beholds is as much the product of his civilization as nature. The tourist sees broadly the great spaces, but his gaze glides. It seizes nothing. It does not perceive the role of each ingredient in the dynamic architecture of the countryside. Only the hunter, imitating the perpetual alertness of the wild animal, for whom everything is danger, sees everything and sees each thing functioning as facility or difficulty, as risk or protection. Ortega believed that in hunting we returned to nature because hunting is the generic way of being a man, and because the animal we are stalking summons the animal still in us. This is atavism, pure and simple. The recovery of an earlier mode of being human, and that for Ortega is the supreme and the exclusive value of hunting. For perhaps his most outrageous claim is that the hunt is the only such return available to us. We can't ever, as he points out, go back to being Christian in the manner of St. Augustine, say, because once history begins, it is irreversible. So how is it we can still go back to being Paleolithic? Because our identity as hunters is literally prehistoric, is in fact inscribed by evolution in the architecture of our bodies and brains. Of course, the same might be said about gathering too, which Ortega doesn't address. My guess is that that way of being in nature is insufficiently dramatic or masculine for the Spaniard's taste. Much that surrounds hunting nowadays is completely artificial, Ortega freely admits, yet the experience itself, the encounter of predator and prey, is no fiction. Just ask the animals. Even though the hunt takes place during a brief vacation from modern life, what occurs in the space of that electrifying parenthesis will ever and always be, in a word Ortega never shrinks from using, authentic. Ready or not? As I said, all this seemed much less crazy to me after I'd been in the woods that first morning with my gun, long before I even had occasion to fire it. I'm chagrined to report that the occasion never presented itself during that first hunting trip. Or rather, when it did present itself, I was in no position to do anything about it. I know, I've been talking here like Mr. Big Game Hunter, comparing notes on the experience with the likes of Ortega y Gasset, but I returned from the woods that day not only empty-handed, which in hunting is entirely forgivable, but, what is not, having failed as a hunter because I was not ready. I blame this, at least partly, on lunch. By the end of the morning, one animal had been shot, a small boar taken by Jean-Pierre. He and Richard had spotted two pigs in the lower forest, a big one and a little one, but by the time they could agree on whose shot it was, Richard politely deferring to his guest, Jean-Pierre, to his host, the bigger one had bolted. On our way back up to the ridge in the ATV, Angelo and I picked up Jean-Pierre's animal. It wasn't a whole lot bigger than a poodle, with a florid red blotch erupting from the side of its bristly black head. Angelo hung it by its ankles from the limb of a tree near the cars. He planned to dress it after lunch. Being Europeans, as well as accomplished cooks, Angelo and Jean-Pierre take lunch very seriously, even when out in the woods some distance from civilization. "So I brought with me a few little things to nibble on," Jean-Pierre mumbled. "Me too," chimed Angelo. And out of their packs came course after course of the most astonishing picnic, which they proceeded to lay out on the hood of Angelo's SUV. A tureen of lobster and halibut en gelée, artisanal salami and prosciutto and mortadella, Angelo's homemade pâté of boar and home-cured olives, cornichons, chicken salad, a generous selection of cheeses and breads, fresh strawberries and pastries, silverware and napkins, and, naturally, a bottle each of red and white wine. It was a delicious lunch, but arguably it took off some of my hunter's edge. One of the easier questions on my hunter education exam went something like this. Hunting while intoxicated is an acceptable practice, true or false? Not that I was intoxicated, but I was feeling notably relaxed and loquacious when Richard and I set off to look for another pig, while Angelo dressed the little one and Jean-Pierre, having already shot a pig, had a postprandial snooze in the grass. Our rifles slung over our shoulders, we strolled down a shady trail toward a spot where Richard had once had some luck, all the while getting acquainted and chatting about one thing or another. We soon discovered we'd both once worked for the same newspaper, so there was fresh gossip to be traded, scandals to dissect. Thoroughly absorbed in conversation, our attention gradually floated off from these woods all the way to a building in midtown Manhattan. Until, that is, I happened to glance up ahead and saw directly in front of us, not 30 yards away, three or four large black shapes swimming in the shadows. The path ahead was deeply shaded by a steep embankment and a large oak, but the sight of these pigs, my first, was incontrovertible, and their sudden appearance violently wrenched my attention back to the forest's present. There they were, four large pigs milling beneath the oak, their attention fixed on the acorns littering the path that connected us. Incredibly, they gave no sign that they'd spotted us or heard our yammering. I grabbed Richard by the shoulder, put my finger to his lips, and pointed ahead. He stopped. "It's your shot," he whispered. "Go ahead. Take it." It is the custom when hunting with companions that the first shot belongs to the person who spotted the animal, perhaps in recognition of the fact that skill in hunting is as much about finding the game as killing it. In fact, in many hunter-gatherer societies, the first portion of meat belongs not to the hunter who kills the animal, but to the one to whom it first appeared. These pigs were mine. One little problem. I had neglected to pump my rifle before we set out on the trail. There was no bullet in the chamber, and to cock my gun now would almost surely alert the pigs to our presence. I could take the chance, but to do so probably meant the pigs would be on the run by the time I was ready to shoot. I explained all this in a whisper to Richard, whose own gun, a fancy new Finnish bolt-action job, could be loaded with a little more than a click of the little bolt. I gave him my shot. Richard got down on one knee and slowly raised his rifle to his shoulder. I braced for the explosion, preparing to pump my gun the moment it came. Perhaps I could still get off a shot at one of the others. Richard took his time, aiming carefully, waiting for one of the animals to turn and offer its flank. The pigs had their heads down, eating acorns, utterly oblivious to our presence. Then the woods exploded. I saw a pig stagger and fall back against the embankment, then struggle drunkenly to its feet. I pumped my rifle, but it was already too late. The other pigs were gone. Richard fired again at the wounded pig, and it crumpled. The other pigs had run down the path away from us, and we gave chase for a few minutes, but they took off around a bend and we lost them. By the time we returned to the scene, Richard's pig was dead. It was considerably bigger than Jean-Pierre's poodle and appeared to have taken a bullet in the butt. I felt a rush of adrenaline. Maybe it had surged earlier, but only now did I feel all lightheaded and shaky. It hadn't been my shot, yet I felt I'd been party to something momentous, something that felt like a collision of worlds. The shadowy realm of the pigs had crashed into our brightly lit world, and this emissary of that other nation had crossed over from wildlife, become meat. The pig, a sow weighing perhaps 100 pounds, was too heavy to carry, so we took turns dragging it by its rear leg up the path back toward the cars. I now understood in a way I never had before the expression, dead weight. Holding the pig by the ankle just above its delicate hoof, I could still feel its warmth beneath the bristly skin, some fading remnant of its formidable energy. It felt wrong to be dragging the body over the rocky ground, and I had to remind myself that the pig, though still warm, felt nothing. By the time we had dragged the carcass all the way back to the cars, its skin felt cool to the touch. Angelo trotted over to see the animal, excited and impressed and eager to hear our story. It's curious how the hunting story takes shape in the minutes after the shot, as you work through the chaotic simultaneity of that lightning, elusive moment, trying to tease out of the adrenaline fog something linear and comprehensible. Even though we'd both witnessed the event together, Richard and I had taken turns carefully telling one another the story on the long march back, rehearsing our lack of readiness, reviewing the reasons Richard had taken the shot instead of me, trying to nail down the precise distance and number of pigs involved, carefully unpacking the moment and turning our shaky recollections into a consensus of fact. A hunting story. As I watched Angelo drink in our hunting story, I could see the disappointment bloom on his face. It had been my shot, my pig, but I hadn't taken it. "You weren't ready," Angelo said, levelly. "In hunting, you always need to be ready." "So, okay, you learned something today. Next time you will be ready and you will take your shot." He was trying hard not to sound like the disappointed father. Even so, I couldn't help feeling like the disappointing son. So what had really happened? I hadn't been ready to shoot. But why? The practical reasons seemed clear enough. Surely it had made more sense to give my shot to Richard than to risk losing the animal. It was because of my unselfish decision that we now had this pig. Yet maybe there was some deeper sense in which I hadn't been ready. Maybe my failure to have a bullet in the chamber reflected some unconscious reluctance about doing what I was asking myself to do. The fact is, I'd blown it, and I wasn't sure how deep I should go in search of an explanation. And yet I had been, and still was, determined to shoot a pig. I had a meal to cook, for one thing, but I was also genuinely hungry for the experience, to learn whatever it had to teach me. So I spent the rest of the afternoon hunting intently alone, walking the ridge, raking the shadows for signs of pig, looking and listening as hard as I could to will another animal out of the woods. When Angelo announced it was time to go home, I felt deflated. Jean-Pierre generously offered to give me some cuts of his pig. Since I needed the meat for my meal, I was grateful for his offer, yet I understood that to accept it underscored my inferior status in our little society of hunters. To the successful hunter goes the privilege of giving away the spoils, and I'd read a lot in the anthropological literature suggesting just how important that privilege was. The sheer nutritional density of meat has always made it a precious form of social currency among hunter-gatherers. Since the successful hunter often ends up with more meat than he or his family could eat before it spoiled, it makes good sense for him to, in effect, bank the surplus in the bodies of other people, trading meat for obligations and future favors. Chimps will do the same thing. Not to say that Jean-Pierre was lording it over me or demanding anything in return. He wasn't. But that didn't change the fact that here I stood, on the vaguely pathetic receiving end of the alpha hunter's meat gift. I briefly considered trying to educate Richard about the traditional meat rites of the game spotter, but thought better of it. I thanked Jean-Pierre for the gift. In the days after, I wasn't sure whether I needed to go hunting again. I had my meat, and I had been hunting. I felt like I had a good idea of what it was all about, or nearly all about. The hunter's way of being in nature and the way of the pigs. I'd spotted the prey and witnessed the kill. I had a pretty good story, too. And yet everyone to whom I told it managed to remind me how unsatisfactory the ending was. "You mean you never even fired your gun?" I'd violated the Chekhovian dramatic rule. Having introduced a loaded gun in Act One, the curtain can't come down until it is fired. I might miss, but the gun had to be fired. That, at least, seemed to be the narrative imperative. And then, of course, there was Señora Ortega y Gasset, who, as you might expect, was not about to accept me into the fellowship of hunters until I'd actually killed an animal. Mere spectatorship, or platonic analogues of hunting such as photography or bird-watching, doesn't cut it for him. Platonism, he writes, represents the maximum tradition of affected piety. One can refuse to hunt, he allows, but if one hunts, one has to accept certain ultimate requirements without which the reality, hunting, evaporates. Killing is one of those requirements. And although Ortega says one does not hunt in order to kill, he also says that one must kill in order to have hunted. Why? For authenticity's sake. If, for me, this venture was about taking ultimate responsibility for the animals I eat, their deaths included, well, I hadn't done that yet, had I? I emailed Angelo and asked him to let me know the next time he planned to go hunting. He wrote back saying he would give me 48 hours' notice to get ready. End of Disc 11. My Pig. Word came about a month later, on a May Friday, that we were to meet at a gas station in Sonoma the following Monday morning, 6 a.m. sharp. This time, it would be just the two of us. We drove the last few miles together in Angelo's SUV, following a deserted road north of Heldsburg that curved extravagantly through deeply creased hills in the process of turning from winter green to summery gold. To me that morning, all the hills looked like the backs and shoulders of great beasts, the thick grasses covering them like pelts. Coming around the final bend, before we reached Richard's Gate, I spotted on my side a large group of pigs, big ones and babies together, right there on the hillside that sloped down to meet the road. Angelo pulled over onto the shoulder. The pigs were on Richard's land, he said. I remembered from Hunter Ed that you weren't allowed to shoot from a public roadway. So we decided we'd try to spook the pigs, force them up over the crest of the hill and down the other side, which would bring them into Richard's forest. We honked, we hollered, we got out of the truck and waved our arms like lunatics, and eventually the pigs started to move up the hill. "This gives me a very good feeling," Angelo said as we climbed back into the truck. And then he offered the prediction slash prayer. "You are going to shoot your pig today. A big pig." I had my doubts, yet seeing those pigs did seem like a promising sign. They were up and about, feeding and on the move. We spent the first part of the morning doing the circuit of Angelo's customary spots, patrolling first the ridge in the ATV and then moving down into the lower forest on foot. The entire day I kept around in my chamber. It was hotter than last time, so Angelo felt the pigs would be keeping to the shadier parts of the property. We staked out a wallow deep in the woods, and then a trampled clearing of ferns on the near side of the hill that abuts the road, but saw no signs of the group we'd tried to herd this way. A little after 9 in the morning, we were walking together down a logging road cut into a steep hillside when we were stopped in our tracks by a grunt so loud and deep and guttural that it seemed to be coming from the bowels of the earth. A very big pig was very close by. But where? What direction to look? The sound had no address. This was the grunt of the ground itself, omnipresent, more audible to my torso than my ears. We crouched down low, making ourselves as inconspicuous as possible, and listened as hard as I've ever listened for anything before. Listened the way you listen when you hear a strange sound in the night. I needn't have strained so, because the next sound we heard was nearly as loud as the first. The sharp, clean crack of a branch coming from above us to our right, where the thickly oaked hillside climbed steeply to a crest. A stream ran down the hillside and crossed the path in front of us about 30 yards ahead. With my eyes, I followed the silvery line of the stream up through the woods to the crest, and that's when I saw it. A rounded black form, a negative of sunrise, coming over the top of the hill. Then another black sun and another, a total of 5 or 6, I couldn't be sure, popping over the crest in a line like a string of huge black pearls. I touched Angelo on the shoulder and pointed toward the pigs. What should I do? This time my gun was cocked, of course, and now, for the first time, I took off the safety. Should I shoot? No, you wait, Angelo said. See, they're coming down the hill now. I followed the pigs with the barrel of my gun, trying to get one of them in my sight. My finger rested lightly on the trigger, and it took all the self-restraint I could summon not to squeeze, but I didn't have a clear shot. Too many trees stood in the way. Take your time, Angelo whispered. They will come to us. And so they did, following the stream bed down to the road directly in front of us, moving toward us in an excruciatingly slow parade. I have no idea how long it took the pigs to pick their way down the steep hill, whether it was minutes or just seconds. At last, the first animal, a big black one, stepped out into the clearing of the dirt road, followed by another that was just as big but much lighter in color. The second pig presented its flank. Now, Angelo whispered, this is your shot. I could sense Angelo a step or two behind me, preparing to take his shot the second I took mine. We were both down on one knee. I braced the rifle against my shoulder and lined up my sight. I felt calmer and clearer than I expected to. At least, when I looked down the barrel of the rifle, it didn't appear to be wagging uncontrollably. I took aim at the shoulder of the grayish pig, aligning the sights you and I with the top of the animal's front leg, and then inched down a shade, hoping to correct for the fact that at the rifle range my shots had all landed several inches high. I held my breath, resisted a sudden urge to clamp my eyes shut, and gently squeezed. The crystal stillness of the scene and the moment in time now exploded into a thousand shards of sense. The pigs erupted in panic, moving every which way at once like black bumper cars, and then the blam of Angelo's shot directly behind made me jump. One pig was down, another seemed to stagger. I pumped my gun to fire again, but the adrenaline was surging now, and I was shaking so violently that my finger accidentally pressed the trigger before I could lower my gun. The shot went wild, skying far over the heads of the rioting pigs. Something like the fog of war now descended on the scene, and I'm uncertain exactly what happened next, but I believe Angelo fired a second time. I collected myself just enough to pump and fire one more poorly aimed round before the pigs dispersed, most of them tumbling down the steep embankment to our left. We ran forward to the downed animal, a very large grayish sow beached on her side across the dirt road. A glossy marble of blood bubbled directly beneath her ear. The pig thrashed briefly, attempting to lift her head, then gave it up. Death was quickly overtaking her, and I was relieved she wouldn't need a second shot. We ran past her, looking for the others. Angelo said he thought he had grazed another one, and I climbed down the embankment looking for it, but very quickly the going got treacherously steep, and Angelo called me back up to the road to see what I'd done. Angelo clapped me on the back and congratulated me extravagantly. Your first pig. Look at the size of it. And with a perfect shot right in the head. You did it. Did I do it? Was that really my shot? I thought my first shot had dropped the pig, but already that moment was blurred irretrievably, and when I saw what a clean shot it was, I suddenly had my doubts. Yet Angelo was adamant. He had fired at a different pig, a black one. No, this is your pig, Michael. You killed it. There's no doubt in my mind. Our hunting story was taking form, the fluid confusion of the moment rapidly hardening into something sturdier and sharper than it really was. What a great shot, Angelo continued. You got yourself a big one. That's some very nice prosciutto. Meat I was not yet quite ready to see. What I saw was a dead wild animal, its head lying on the dirt in a widening circle of blood. I kneeled down and pressed the palm of my hand against the pig's belly above the nipples and felt beneath the dusty, bristly skin her warmth, but no heartbeat. My emotions were as surging and confused as the knot of panicked pigs had been on the spot just a moment before. The first to surface was this powerful upwelling of pride. I had actually done this thing I'd set out to do, had successfully shot a pig. I felt a flood of relief, too, that the deed was done, thank God, and didn't need to be done again. And then there was this wholly unexpected feeling of gratitude. But for what exactly, or to whom? For my good fortune, I guess, and to Angelo, of course, but also to this animal, for stepping unbidden over the crest of that hill, out of the wild and into my sight, to become what Angelo kept calling her, your pig. More than the product of any labor of mine, save receptiveness, the animal was a gift. From who or what, I couldn't say, but gratitude seemed in order, and gratitude is what I felt. The one emotion I expected to feel but did not, inexplicably, was remorse, or even ambivalence. All that would come later, but now, I'm slightly embarrassed to admit, I felt absolutely terrific. Unambiguously happy. Angelo wanted to take my picture, so he posed me behind my pig, one hand cradling the rifle across my chest, the other resting on the animal. I couldn't decide whether to smile or to compose a more somber expression. I opted for the latter, but I couldn't quite manage to untie the knot of my smile. Every good hunter is uneasy in the depths of his conscience when faced with the death he is about to inflict on the enchanting animal, I'd read in Ortega y Gasset's Meditations. But I was unable to locate this feeling, either immediately before or after the fateful shot. Nor did I register, yet anyway, the slightest disgust at the creeping stain of the animal's blood on the ground, the stain that I remembered Ortega calling a degradation. I was still too excited, too interested in this most improbable drama in which I had somehow found myself playing the hero's part. Making meat. The sense of elation didn't last. Less than an hour later, I found myself in a much less heroic role, embracing the pig's hanging carcass from behind to steady it so Angelo could reach in and pull out its viscera. I was playing the nurse now, passing him tools and holding the patient still. Using a block and tackle and a stainless steel hanger with two hooks that Angelo had forged expressly for this purpose, we'd managed to raise and hang the pig by its rear ankles from the stout limb of an oak tree. A scale attached to the rig gave the weight of the animal, 190 pounds. The pig weighed exactly as much as I did. Dead bodies are awkward, among other things, and negotiating one this big proved a difficult, clumsy, and oddly intimate operation. It took us a while, but we managed to hoist the pig up onto the hood of the ATV, get it up the hill without falling off, and then into this tree. I kept finding myself in awkward embraces with my pig, as when I had to press with all my weight against the carcass when it threatened to slide down off the hood, or when Angelo needed me to wrap my arms around the pig to keep it from swinging while he cut into it. Dressing the pig was further complicated by the fact that we planned on making prosciutto, which requires that the hide covering the hams be left intact. So instead of skinning the hindquarters, we had to shave them, painstakingly scraping the animal's dust-caked thighs with our knife blades to remove all her bristles. Next, Angelo made a shallow incision along an equator circling the pig's belly and began to gently work the hide loose. I held down a narrow flap of skin while he cut into the fat behind it, leaving as much of the creamy white adipose layer on the carcass as possible. "This is really good fat," Angelo explained, "for the salami." The flap of skin grew larger as we worked our way down the body and then slowly pulled it down over the pig's shoulders until the inside-out skin looked like a discarded sweater caught in the instant it comes over the head. What hunters call dressing an animal is really an undressing. As we drew the skin down over the ribcage, it exposed the bullet, or what remained of the bullet. It had torn a ragged slot in the last rib and come to rest there, just beneath the hide. "Here's a souvenir for you," Angelo said, extracting the bloody, mangled chunk of metal from the bone like a tooth and handing it to me. The bullet was too smashed up to easily identify its caliber, though it occurred to me a forensics expert could probably determine whether it had really come from my rifle. Settle once and for all. The words Warren Commission popped into my head, whether or not there had been a second gunman. Angelo worked with a small cigar clamped between his teeth. The smoke discouraged the flies and yellow jackets, which had taken an avid interest in the dead animal. There was also a pair of turkey vultures circling high overhead, patiently waiting for us to finish. Whatever parts of this pig we didn't take, the local fauna were preparing to set upon and consume, weaving this bonanza of fat and protein back into the fabric of the land. Using a short knife, Angela made another shallow incision the length of the animal's belly, moving very slowly so as not to pierce any internal organs. A punctured bladder would give the meat a nasty, ineradicable taint, he explained, and cutting into the colon risked contaminating it with intestinal bacteria. Angela talked while he worked, mostly, if you can believe it, about food. As he cut into the thin, visceral membrane that held all the organs in the body cavity in a translucent bag, he told me all about ventricina, a dish made in Abruzzi that involves stuffing the visceral membrane with various noble cuts of the pig and then hanging it to cure like a salami. It's tricky to keep the bag from tearing, but one of these days I'll make some. I could not believe Angelo was still talking about food. The pig was splayed open now, all its internal organs glistening in their place like one of those cutaway anatomy dolls from biology. The bluish links of intestine coiled beneath the stout muscle of the heart, beribboned with its map of veins. The spongy pink pair of lungs like outspread wings behind, and below, the sleek chocolate slab of liver. I'd handled plenty of viscera in the chickens I'd gutted on Joel's farm, but this was different and more disturbing, probably because the pig's internal organs, in their proportions and arrangement and colors, looked exactly like human organs. Which is why I recalled surgeons hone their skills by operating on pigs. I held the cavity open while Angela reached in to pull out the mass of organs, hoping to save the liver, which had a jagged tear across it. The bullet had apparently crossed the rib cage diagonally from upper left to lower right, tearing through a lobe of the liver. But Angelo thought the liver was salvageable, for a nice pâté, so he cut it free and dropped it into a Ziploc bag. Then he reached in and pulled gently, and the rest of the viscera tumbled out onto the ground in a heap, up from which rose a stench so awful it made me gag. This was not just the stink of pig shit or piss, but those comparatively benign smells compounded by an odor so wretched and ancient that death alone could release it. I felt a wave of nausea begin to build in my gut. The clinical disinterest with which I had approached the whole process of cleaning my pig collapsed all at once. This was disgusting. I still had my arms wrapped around the pig from behind, holding it steady and open, but I needed badly to break away for a moment to locate an uncontaminated breath. So I told Angelo I wanted to take a picture of him working on the pig. This was not a picture I particularly wanted, to the contrary, but the time and distance that snapping it now promised suddenly seemed precious beyond reason. I turned away and gulped a breath of clean air, then went off, blessed errand, in search of Angelo's camera. Since it was my plan to cook, serve, and eat this animal, the revulsion at its sight and smell that now consumed me was discouraging, to say the least. That plan was no longer just a narrative conceit either, since the moment I killed this pig, I felt it descend on me with the weight of a moral obligation. And yet now the prospect of sitting down to a meal of this animal was unthinkable. Pâté? Prosciutto? Ventricina? Just then I could have made myself vomit simply by picturing myself putting a fork to a bite of this pig. How was I ever going to get past this? And what was this spasm of revulsion all about, anyway? Disgust, I understood, is one of the tools humans have evolved to navigate the omnivore's dilemma. The emotion alerts us to things we should not ingest, like rotten meat or feces. And surely that protective reflex figured in what I was feeling as I beheld these viscera, which no doubt did contain things that could sicken me. The stink in my nostrils was probably the contents of the pig's intestines, which had split open on the ground in various stages of digestion and decomposition. So here, I guess, was the intuitive microbiology of disgust at work. But there had to be more to it than that. And later, when I went back and reread Paul Rosen on disgust, I had a better idea of what else might underlie my revulsion. As Rosen had written, most of the things that disgust people universally do come from animals. Bodily fluids and secretions, decaying flesh, corpses. This makes meat eating especially problematic, which might explain why cultures have more rules and taboos governing the eating of meat than of any other food. Rules that specify not only which animals are okay to eat and not, but which parts of those animals and how they must be killed. Beyond the sanitary reasons for avoiding certain parts and products of animals, these things disgust us, Rosen suggests, because they confront us with the reality of our own animal nature. So much of the human project is concerned with distinguishing ourselves from beasts that we seem strenuously to avoid things that remind us that we are beasts too. Animals that urinate, defecate, copulate, bleed, die, stink, and decompose. Rosen tells a story about Cotton Mather, who confided to his journal the powerful revulsion he felt at finding himself urinating alongside a dog. Mather turned his self-disgust into a resolution of self-transcendence. Yet I will be a more noble creature. At the very time when my natural necessities debase me into the condition of the beast, my spirit shall, I say at that very time, rise and soar. Exactly why we would strive so hard to distance ourselves from our animality is a large question, but surely the human fear of death figures in the answer. What we see animals do an awful lot of is die, very often at our hands. Animals resist dying, but having no conception of death, they don't give it nearly as much thought as we do. And one of the main thoughts about it, we think, is, will my own death be like this animal's or not? The belief or hope that human death is somehow different from animal death is precious to us, but unprovable. Whether it is or is not is one of the questions I suspect we're trying to answer whenever we look into the eyes of an animal. From the moment I laid eyes on my animal, straight through to the moment Angelo sawed off her head, her eyes remained tightly shut beneath her disconcerting eyelashes. Yet everything else about the episode asked me to confront these kinds of questions. What disgusted me about cleaning the animal was just how messy, in every sense of the word, the process really was. How it forced me to look at and smell and touch and even to taste the death at my hands of a creature my size that, on the inside at least, had all the same parts and probably looked an awful lot like I did. Such an encounter is no doubt more disturbing to someone who, like me, lacks the religious certainty that humans have souls and animals don't, period. The line between human and animal that I could discern here was nowhere near that sharp. Cannibalism is one of the things that most deeply disgusts us, and while this isn't by any reasonable definition that, you could forgive the mind for being fooled into reacting as if it were, in disgust. Here, I decided, was one of the signal virtues of hunting. It puts large questions about who we and the animals are and the nature of our respective deaths squarely before the hunter. And while I'm sure there are many hunters who manage to avoid their gaze, that must take some doing. As Ortega writes in his Meditations, hunting plunges us into the intertwined enigmas of death and animals, enigmas that admit of no easy answers or resolution. This, for him, is the wellspring of the hunter's uneasiness. He does not have the final and firm conviction that his conduct is correct. But neither, it should be understood, is he certain of the opposite. Ambivalence and ambiguity are the hunter's lot, and according to Ortega, it has probably ever been thus. Like John Berger, he believes that the mystery of animals, How they can be at once so like and unlike us has always been one of the central mysteries of human life. Humanity sees itself as something emerging from animality, but it cannot be sure of having transcended that state completely. The animal remains too close for us not to feel mysterious communication with it. Those moderns who have had the clearest idea about the animals, and therefore the least uneasiness about killing them, were the Cartesians, who decided animals were, in effect, mineral, insensible machines.